exactly embrace it, especially at those times when you could really use an embrace. But what about when you're expecting, and he's expecting to be deployed? How do you stay connected when you're separated during the ultimate life event, pregnancy, and even separated at your baby's birth? With a little creativity and a lot of technology, here are some ideas to get you started. Document your bump. Start every morning with a bump selfie. It may not seem to change much from day to day, but getting a daily bump update in his inbox will make his day, every day. Plus, you'll both get a kick out of looking back on your tummy transformation from flat to fabulously round later on. As you close in on delivery, consider splurging on a maternity photo shoot meant just for him. Decorate your bump. Ready to unleash your inner artist while keeping close during holidays? Send holiday greetings on your bump. Mark 4th of July with a flag, Halloween with a pumpkin, Thanksgiving with a turkey, Christmas with a tree. Follow along together. Start a long-distance baby book club. Get him a matching copy of this book, and later, What to Expect the First Year, so you can listen together. Download the What to Expect app together, so you can watch the videos and share the updates on your baby's progress, as well as help him understand all those crazy symptoms you've been venting about. Play the name game, too. Share a baby name app and toss around contenders. Take him to checkups. If time zones and schedules permit, try to book some of your prenatal checkups when he can attend via video chat, and make sure he gets a chance to ask any questions he has. Same for any ultrasound appointments. If he can't video chat in for the appointments, try to get a selection of ultrasound stills or video clips to send him. And for his listening pleasure, try recording baby's heartbeat. Connect over cravings. Can't get enough black olive and peanut butter sandwiches? Bananas for bananas? Create a cravings care package so he can get a taste of home and a taste for what you're craving. Find substitutes for items that won't travel well, like the bananas. You can send him a bag of the freeze-dried kind. Or send him a photo of the extreme sundae baby had you building at 2 a.m. last night. Do a long-distance gender reveal. If you're planning to find out your baby's sex when he or she reveals it at your 20-week ultrasound, or via an elaborate gender reveal party, make sure daddy's able to join in. Video chat during the reveal, or have the friend or relative who's gotten the gender 411 pack up matching boxes of pink or blue confetti or candy to send to him and give to you, to be opened via video chat at the same time. Get him bonding with baby. From about the 6th month on, a baby's sense of hearing is well developed, so put it to good use and let the bonding begin. Whenever you're video chatting or on the phone, put the audio close enough to your bump so baby can hear the sound of daddy's voice, which will already be music to your little one's ears. That way, baby will recognize daddy's voice right from the start. Another way to bond, put together a highlights reel to send to him of baby's hiccups, pokes, and squirms once they're visible from the outside. Go shopping together. So maybe he doesn't have the time to scroll through pages of cribs, strollers, and monitors, and maybe he's just as happy that way. But he'd probably like to vote on the finalists once you've narrowed the nursery and gear field a bit. Same for paint colors and theme choices for baby's room. Take step-by-step pictures as you remodel baby's room or nook. Make sure you're not doing the painting and heavy lifting. And sign up for your online baby registry together. Find the support you need. Every mom-to-be needs a strong support system, a shoulder to cry on, someone to vent to, someone to cheer her on, or share special moments with. You need it and deserve it even more. Connect with other military moms-to-be, online or on base, supporting each other and sharing resources. The local USO can provide support and programs that bring moms together too, as well as help with resources. Enlist a friend or relative to be your stand-in coach if your partner won't be home for delivery. Hopefully, you'll be able to video chat every step of the way and take childbirth classes and breastfeeding classes and infant CPR classes together. Also, consider adding a doula to your birthing team. Many doulas offer services free or at a discounted rate to military moms, especially those who have a partner deployed. And if you feel you need more than a friend to talk to, if you're feeling depressed or anxious, having trouble eating or sleeping or taking care of yourself, ask your practitioner for help. Professional counseling, possibly combined with a support group, can help immeasurably. Get centered. If there's a centering pregnancy program at your base, consider signing up for the extra support and camaraderie it offers. Your medical history.
Obesity. I'm about 60 pounds overweight. Does this put my baby and me at higher risk during pregnancy?
Most overweight moms, and even those who are obese, defined as someone whose weight is 20% or more over ideal weight, have completely safe pregnancies and completely healthy babies. Still, carrying a lot of extra weight while you're carrying a baby does increase the possibility of certain pregnancy complications, including miscarriage, birth defects, stillbirth, preterm birth, high blood pressure, and gestational diabetes, GD. Being overweight poses some practical pregnancy problems too. The extra layers of fat may make it trickier for a practitioner to determine a fetus's size and position, as well as make it harder for you to feel those first kicks. And a prolonged labor and difficult delivery can result if a baby is much larger than average, which is often the case when mom is obese, particularly if she's diabetic and even if she hasn't gained too much weight during pregnancy. And if a cesarean delivery is necessary, obesity can complicate both the surgery and recovery from it. Then there's the issue of pregnancy comfort, or rather, discomfort. And unfortunately, as the pounds multiply, so do those uncomfortable pregnancy symptoms. Extra pounds, whether they're pounds you already had or pounds you added during pregnancy, can spell extra backache, varicose veins, swelling, heartburn, and more. Discouraged? Don't be. There's plenty you and your practitioner can do to minimize the extra risks of those extra pounds, as well as the extra discomforts. It'll just take some extra effort. On the medical side, you may be monitored more closely than the typical average weight woman. For instance, you may be screened for GD earlier and more often, and have extra ultrasounds to check on your baby's size. As for your part, good self-care can make a big difference. Eliminating all pregnancy risks that are within your control, such as drinking and smoking, will be particularly important for you. Keeping your weight gain on target will be too, and it's likely that your target will be smaller than the average expectant mom's and monitored by your doctor more closely. ACOG recommends that overweight women gain 15 to 20 pounds and obese women gain no more than 15 pounds, though your practitioner's recommendations may differ. In fact, some practitioners recommend that obese women pack on no extra pounds at all during pregnancy. But again, stick to the plan your doctor or midwife has mapped out for you. Even with a scaled-down bottom line to stick to, your daily diet should be packed with foods that are concentrated sources of vitamins, minerals, and protein. Focusing on the quality of the calories you choose will make them count and will help your baby get the most nutritional bang from every bite you take. Taking your prenatal vitamin faithfully will provide extra insurance. Getting regular exercise within the guidelines recommended by your practitioner will allow you to eat more of the healthy foods you and your baby need without packing on too many pounds. Combine regular exercise, the right amount of weight gain, and a healthy diet, and you'll also lower your risk of developing GD. Wondering whether you can keep your pregnancy weight gain down by popping supplements and sipping beverages that claim to suppress appetite? These can be dangerous during pregnancy, so stay away from them, even if they are marketed as natural. For your next pregnancy, if you are planning one, try to get as close as possible to your ideal weight before you conceive. It will make everything about pregnancy a lot easier and less potentially complicated. Underweight.
I've always been skinny. I have a hard time gaining weight. Will being underweight have any impact on my pregnancy?
Pregnancy is definitely a time for eating well and gaining weight, both for the skinny and the not so skinny. But if you've come into pregnancy on the super skinny side, with a BMI of 18.5 or less, you'll have to be filling up your plate even more. That's because there are some potential risks, such as having a small for date baby and preterm birth, associated with being pregnant and extremely underweight, particularly if you're also undernourished. This is far less likely if you're a healthy eater who just happens to be naturally thin. But any added risk can be eliminated by eating well, getting plenty of calories and nutrients, taking a prenatal vitamin, and gaining enough weight. Depending on where you started out on the scale, your practitioner may advise you to gain a little extra, possibly 28 to 40 pounds instead of the 25 to 35 pounds recommended for the average weight woman. As long as your weight gain stays on track, though, your pregnancy shouldn't encounter any other bumps besides that belly bump. An eating disorder.
I've been bulimic for almost 10 years. I thought I'd be able to stop now that I'm pregnant, but I can't seem to. Will it hurt my baby?
Not if you get the right kind of help right away. The fact that you've been bulimic or anorexic for a number of years means your nutritional reserves are probably low, putting your baby and your body at a disadvantage right off the bat. Fortunately, early in pregnancy, the need for nourishment is less than it will be later on. So you have the chance to make up for your body's nutritional shortfall before it can hurt your baby. Very little research has been done in the area of eating disorders in pregnancy, partly because these disorders often disrupt the menstrual cycle, which means few women suffering from these problems become pregnant in the first place. But the studies that have been done suggest that binging and purging during pregnancy, in other words, active bulimia, seems to increase the risk of miscarriage and premature birth, as well as postpartum depression. Active anorexia during pregnancy increases the risk of miscarriage, preeclampsia, preterm delivery, and cesarean delivery. Taking laxatives, diuretics, appetite suppressants, and other drugs sometimes used by bulimics and anorexics can also be harmful during pregnancy. They draw off nutrients and fluids from your body before they can be used to nourish your baby and later to produce milk, and may lead to multiple serious problems, including possible birth defects, if used regularly. And not gaining enough weight during pregnancy can lead to a number of problems, including preterm delivery and a baby who's born small for his or her gestational age. Happily, the studies also suggest that if you put those unhealthy habits behind you now, you're just as likely to have a healthy baby as anyone else, all other things being equal. If you're having trouble eating normally and well, having a hard time distinguishing between morning sickness and bulimia, or if you've been hiding your bulimia under the cover of morning sickness, make sure you get the help you need. Start by telling your prenatal practitioner about your eating disorder, not only so he or she can help make sure it doesn't affect your baby or your pregnancy, but also so you'll get the supportive care you need to get healthy and stay healthy. Your practitioner may be able to refer you to a therapist who's experienced in treating eating disorders. Professional counseling is always smart when you've been battling anorexia or bulimia, but it's really essential when you're trying to eat well for two. You may also find support groups helpful. Check online or ask your practitioner or therapist for a recommendation. Just being committed to conquering your eating disorder so that you can start nurturing that beautiful baby of yours is the first and most important step. It will also help to put the dynamics of pregnancy weight gain in perspective. Keep in mind, the pregnant shape is universally viewed as healthy and beautiful. Its roundness is normal, a sign that you're growing a baby. Celebrate those curves. Embrace your pregnant self. You're supposed to gain weight during pregnancy. The right amount of weight, as recommended by your practitioner, gained at the right time on the right foods, is vital to your baby's growth and well-being in utero and beyond. Some of the extra fat you lay down during pregnancy will be used after delivery to help you breastfeed your baby. And this sensible strategy isn't just baby-friendly, it's mom-friendly too. It'll help ensure a healthier, more comfortable pregnancy and a speedier return to your pre-pregnancy shape postpartum. If you're uneasy watching the numbers on the scale climb as you gain that vital weight, Let your practitioner do the watching. Hide your bathroom scale so you won't be tempted to check your weight yourself. And close your eyes during your checkup weigh-ins. Ask the nurse to note the number in your chart without announcing it first. You can and should stay in shape when you're expecting. Exercise can help guide to the right places the extra pounds you need to gain, primarily your baby and baby byproducts. But make sure any exercise you do is pregnancy appropriate and practitioner approved. If you've always been used to strenuous workouts as a way to burn off extra calories you've eaten, it's time to trade in that strategy for a healthier approach. Also, avoid any exercise that raises your temperature excessively, which isn't safe during pregnancy. Saunas and hot yoga are out. You will lose a lot of the pregnancy pounds at delivery, but far from all of them. It can take several months to lose the rest, and realistically, a lot longer to get back into shape. For this reason, women with eating disorders sometimes find that negative feelings about their body image cause them to slip back into binging and purging or starving during the postpartum period. Because those unhealthy habits could interfere with your ability to recover from childbirth, to parent effectively, and to produce enough milk if you choose to breastfeed, it's important that you continue professional counseling postpartum with someone experienced in the treatment of eating disorders. Support groups in your community or online can also help. The most important thing to keep in mind, your baby's well-being depends on your well-being during pregnancy. If you're not well-nourished, your baby won't be either. Positive reinforcement can definitely help. So try putting pictures of cute babies on the fridge, in your office and car, anywhere you might need a reminder of the healthy eating you should be doing. Visualize the food you eat making its way to your baby and your baby happily gobbling up those healthy meals. If you can't seem to stop binging, vomiting, using diuretics or laxatives, or practicing semi-starvation during pregnancy, discuss with your physician the possibility of hospitalization until you get your disorder under control. There's never been a better reason to get and stay healthy.
Pregnancy after weight loss surgery. Have you lost weight thanks to bariatric surgery? Chances are you were told to hold off on becoming pregnant until 12 to 18 months after your surgery, the time of the most drastic weight loss and potential for malnutrition. But now that you've passed that benchmark and are growing a baby, it's time for a double congratulations. You've lost a whole lot of weight and you're about to gain a baby. Pat yourself on the back and rub yourself on the belly, because having lost all that weight, no matter how it happened, gastric sleeve, lap band, or gastric bypass, gives you an even better chance of having a healthy pregnancy and healthy baby. You've lowered your risk for gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, and having a too big baby. How's that for a win-win? Still, there are some extra precautions you will need to take as a mom-to-be who's had weight loss surgery. Keep your weight loss surgeon on your team, now Team Baby. He or she will be best able to advise your OB or midwife on some of the specific needs of a weight loss surgery patient. Keep those vitamins coming. You'll need to keep up with your recommended vitamin supplementation while you're expecting. After all, you're nourishing for two now. A prenatal vitamin is a good start, but you may need more iron, calcium, folic acid, vitamin B12, and vitamin A because of certain malabsorption issues. So discuss your supplement needs with both your prenatal practitioner and your surgeon. Keep your eye on the scale. You're used to watching your weight, of course, but lately you're used to watching it go down. Now that there's a baby on board, you'll probably watch it go up. Your job will be to keep that weight gain goal. Gaining too few pounds or too many can put your pregnancy and your baby at unnecessary risk. Keep in mind that there's an increased chance of having a too small baby after bariatric surgery, but that gaining the right number of pounds can help ensure a healthy bottom line for your baby at birth. Keep an eye on your eating. Eating for two is more challenging when your stomach space has been downsized by weight loss surgery. You may find the challenges multiply too as your uterus and your baby start to grow, crowding out your stomach even more. Since the quantity of food you can comfortably eat is limited, you'll need to focus on quality. Try not to waste space or calories on foods that don't satisfy nutritional requirements, and instead, try to choose foods that efficiently pack the most nutrients into the smallest volume. Keep an eye on your symptoms. If you're experiencing excessive vomiting or nausea, or if you notice any unusual abdominal pain, call your pregnancy practitioner and your bariatric surgeon right away. The symptoms could be pregnancy-related, or they could be something more serious related to your surgery, in which case they would require immediate medical attention. If you have a chronic condition, anyone who's lived with a chronic condition knows that life can get pretty complicated between medications to take and extra doctor's appointments to make, not to mention new therapies and treatments to keep up with. Add pregnancy into the mix, and you've got your plate even fuller. Happily, with some extra precautions, extra effort, and extra care, most chronic conditions are completely compatible with pregnancy. Here are some general recommendations for moms-to-be with a few common chronic conditions, but be sure to follow your doctor's orders, since they've probably been tailored to your specific needs. Diabetes. The key to managing a diabetic pregnancy successfully, whether the diabetes is type 1, in which the body doesn't produce insulin, or type 2, in which the body doesn't respond as it should to insulin, is achieving normal blood glucose levels before conception and maintaining them throughout the 9 months after it. You will be able to do that with a carefully designed diet. It will probably be similar to the pregnancy diet, containing few sugary sweets and refined grains, and plenty of fiber-rich food and healthy snacks. Regular exercise, careful monitoring of your blood sugar, and the right medication, insulin if necessary. You will also be given a pregnancy weight gain goal, which will be especially important to stick to, since gaining too much weight can put you at risk of pregnancy complications. To make sure all is going well, you'll be watched carefully during pregnancy. Along with regular tests for blood sugar levels, you'll also have urine tests to check kidney function and eye exams to check your retinas. And your baby will be checked with a fetal echocardiogram to make sure his or her heart is developing without problems. Your doctor will also watch you closely for early signs of preeclampsia and gestational diabetes, since diabetics are at somewhat higher risk for both those conditions. Because babies of diabetics sometimes grow very large, even if mom's weight is on target, your baby's growth will be monitored more closely using ultrasound. Heavier babies make delivery more difficult. There's a higher chance of childbirth complications and/or cesarean delivery when your baby is very large. Early delivery may be necessary if problems develop late in pregnancy, but your medical team will ensure that baby's lungs are sufficiently mature before inducing labor or performing a C-section. Finally, if you're planning to breastfeed, try to get started as soon as possible after birth, ideally within 30 minutes, and feed every 2 to 3 hours to prevent hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. To play it safe, babies of diabetic moms are usually not discharged from the hospital until they are maintaining blood glucose levels and feeding well. Hypertension. If you have chronic hypertension, your pregnancy will be considered high risk. But with the right medical care and self-care, you're likely to have the best payoff of all, a safe pregnancy and a healthy baby. You'll have to keep track of your blood pressure at home, exercise regularly, which lowers blood pressure, reduce stress through relaxation exercises, meditation, and other CAM therapies, such as biofeedback, eat well, stay hydrated, and keep your weight gain on track. Pregnancy-safe medication, as needed, will also help ensure that your blood pressure stays under control. Medical monitoring will be stepped up, too, to make sure you don't develop preeclampsia. Irritable bowel syndrome. It's hard to pinpoint the effect of pregnancy on IBS, and vice versa, because bowels are often impacted, sometimes literally, by pregnancy. Expectant women are more prone to constipation, a symptom of IBS, and/or looser stools, also a symptom of IBS. Same for gas and bloating, which typically worsen when you're expecting, whether or not you have IBS. To keep your symptoms manageable, stick to the techniques you're used to using to combat IBS during other times in your life. Eat smaller, more frequent meals, stay well hydrated, avoid excess stress, and steer clear of foods or drinks that make your symptoms worse. If you're on the FODMAP diet, check with your practitioner to make sure you're getting the right balance of nutrients for pregnancy. And if you're on medication for help with IBS symptoms, check with your prenatal practitioner to make sure it's pregnancy safe. Not all are. You might also want to consider adding some probiotics. They're surprisingly effective in regulating bowel function. Sickle cell anemia. This condition puts pregnancy at high risk, but with the right care, moms with sickle cell disease, even those with complications like heart or kidney disease, have a good chance of having a safe pregnancy and delivery and a healthy baby. Preeclampsia and hypertension are more common in women with sickle cell anemia, and many women with sickle cell anemia find themselves hospitalized at least once during their 9 months. Complications such as miscarriage, preterm delivery, and fetal growth restriction are also more common. Though it's not certain whether it's beneficial or not, it's possible that you'll be given a blood transfusion at least once or even periodically throughout pregnancy, as well as in early labor or just before delivery. Thyroid disease. If you're hypothyroid, your thyroid doesn't produce enough thyroxine, it's important to keep taking your thyroid pills. They're not only pregnancy safe, but can be pregnancy essential. You'll also need to have your thyroid levels monitored more closely to be sure the dose you're taking is meeting your needs and your baby's. And if you've had a thyroid condition in the past, but since stopped taking meds, let your practitioner know so your levels can be tested again now. Untreated hypothyroidism increases the chance of miscarriage. What's more, babies who don't get enough maternal thyroid hormones in the first trimester can develop neurological problems and possibly deafness. After the first trimester, the fetus makes its own thyroid hormones and is protected even if mom's levels are low. Low thyroid levels are also linked to maternal depression during pregnancy and postpartum, another compelling reason to continue treatment. Iodine deficiency, which is becoming more common among women of childbearing age in the U.S. because of reduced iodized salt consumption, can interfere with the production of the thyroid hormone, so be sure you're getting adequate amounts of this trace mineral. Untreated moderate to severe Graves' disease, aka hyperthyroidism, when the thyroid gland produces excessive amounts of thyroid hormones, can lead to serious complications for both you and your baby, including miscarriage and preterm birth, so appropriate treatment is necessary. Happily, when the disease is treated properly, in pregnancy the treatment of choice is the antithyroid medication propylthiouracil, or PTU, in the lowest effective dose. The outcome is likely to be good for both mom and baby.
Depression. I was diagnosed with depression a few years ago, and I've been on an antidepressant ever since. Now that I'm pregnant, should I stop taking the meds?
Around 15% of women of childbearing age battle bouts of depression, so you are far from alone. Luckily for you and all the other expectant moms who share your condition, there's a sunny forecast. With the right treatment, women with depression can have perfectly normal pregnancies. And happy ones, too. Deciding what that treatment should consist of during pregnancy is a delicate balancing act, however, when it comes to the use of medications. Together with your mental health care provider and your prenatal practitioner, you'll need to weigh the risks and benefits of taking such meds and not taking them while you're growing a baby. Maybe it seems like a simple decision to make, at least at first glance. After all, could there ever be a good reason to put your emotional well-being over your baby's physical well-being? But the decision is actually a lot more complicated than that. For starters, pregnancy hormones can do a number on your emotional state. Even women who've never had an encounter with mood disorders, depression, or any other psychological condition may experience wild emotional swings while they're expecting. But women with a history of depression are at greater risk of having depressive bouts during pregnancy and are more likely to suffer from postpartum depression.
And this is especially true for moms-to-be who stop taking their antidepressants during pregnancy. What's more, untreated depression isn't likely to affect only you and those you're close to. It's also likely to affect your baby's health. Depressed moms-to-be may not eat or sleep well or pay as much attention to their prenatal care, and they may be more likely to turn to unhealthy lifestyle habits like drinking or smoking. Any or all of those factors, combined with the debilitating effects of excessive anxiety and stress, have been linked in some studies to an increased risk of preterm birth, low birth weight, and a lower Apgar score for babies. Treating depression effectively, however, and keeping it under control during pregnancy allows a mother to be to nurture her body and her developing baby. So what does all this mean for you? It means you should think twice before you consider tossing your antidepressants. But it also means that you should consult both with your prenatal practitioner and the doctor and or therapist who's been treating you for depression before you decide what your next medication move should be, if any. Certain meds are safer than others during pregnancy, and some aren't recommended for pregnancy use at all, which means that the med or meds you use preconception might not be the right choice now, or that your dose may need to be changed. Your prenatal practitioner, in conjunction with your mental health care provider, can give you the most up-to-date and accurate information on the safety of antidepressant drugs during pregnancy, because it's ever-changing, as well as often misinterpreted or misreported on the internet. Another reason to look to professional guidance instead of search engines. Research so far has been conflicting, with some studies showing increased risk for autism, cardiac defect, and low birth weight in babies whose moms took certain antidepressants during pregnancy, and other studies showing no correlation at all. What is known right now is that SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, Celexa, Prozac, and Zoloft are generally considered good options during pregnancy. Paxil, another SSRI, is not because it's associated with a small increase in fetal heart defects. SNRIs, serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, such as Cymbalta and Effexor XR, are also among the treatment options for expectant moms. Wellbutrin isn't considered a first-choice medication during pregnancy, but can be used if a woman isn't responding to other options. Here's the important thing to keep in mind as you and your practitioner weigh your options. Though taking any kind of medication during pregnancy, including antidepressants, isn't without risks, experts believe these risks shouldn't keep pregnant women from taking antidepressants if their depression can't be treated effectively in other ways. That's because untreated depression carries its own risks, many with long-term effects. Choosing the safest medication possible, prescribing it at the safest dose possible, and taking it at the safest time during pregnancy as possible will help mitigate the risks of both the depression and the medications. Also remember that there are non-drug treatments for depression that can be quite effective, either on their own, in some cases allowing a mom with mild depression to avoid medication altogether, or when used in conjunction with medication, allowing a mom to take a lower dose of medication or switch to a safer medication. These treatments include psychotherapy, talk therapy, bright light therapy, and complementary and alternative approaches such as acupuncture and possibly neurotherapy. Exercise for its release of feel-good endorphins, meditation, which can help you manage stress, and diet, keeping blood sugar up with regular healthy meals and snacks, can also be beneficial additions to a treatment program. Talk to your practitioner and mental health care provider to see if these options have a place in yours. ADHD.
I was diagnosed with ADHD as a teenager and have been taking daily medication for it ever since. Do I have to stop taking my meds during pregnancy?
Plenty of adults take amphetamines like Adderall or methylphenidates, like Concerta or Ritalin, to help stay focused and functioning socially and at work. And that includes plenty of women who ultimately become pregnant. The problem is there isn't much known about the safety of these drugs during pregnancy, since they haven't been well studied in humans, only in animals. At this point, they've been categorized as medications that haven't been shown to be harmful to a fetus, but haven't been proven harmless either. So what's a human mom-to-be to do? First, talk to your pregnancy practitioner, as well as to the doctor who prescribed the medication. Ask about the latest on the safety of stimulant medications during pregnancy, and discuss whether you should continue using them or not, or whether you should stop using them during the first trimester and resume use during the second. Any potential risk of taking the medication during pregnancy will, of course, have to be balanced against the potential risks of letting your ADHD go untreated. Ask, too, about non-drug treatments for ADHD, such as cognitive behavioral therapy or clinical coaching, that could act as alternatives to the use of stimulants during pregnancy or as supplements to a lower dose of those medications. Finally, remember that no matter what treatment you end up with, pregnancy can do a number on your focus, concentration, and functioning, and that a hormone-induced fog settles on just about every expectant mom. Having a baby after 35.
I'm 38 and thrilled to be pregnant for the first time, but I wonder what my age means for my pregnancy and my baby.
Being over 35 and pregnant with your first baby means you're in good and steadily growing company. Also growing the number of moms over 40 having baby number one. And your good company shares good news. The risks of pregnancy are very small to begin with and rise only slightly and gradually as you get older. Most of the risks that do rise can be reduced or even eliminated. So first, the risks. The major reproductive risks faced by a woman over 35, an age group perhaps unfairly referred to as advanced maternal age or AMA, is that she might not become pregnant at all due to the slight and very gradual decline in fertility that begins once a woman has exited the optimum fertility window of her early 20s. So it's not downhill overnight at age 35. Now that you've got conception covered, congrats, you face a somewhat increased chance of having a baby with Down syndrome. Here again, it's a relatively low risk that increases gradually as moms get older. 1 in 1,250 for 25-year-old moms, about 3 in 1,000 for 30-year-old moms, 1 in about 300 for 35-year-old moms, and 1 in 35 for 45-year-old moms. It's speculated that the gradual rise in this and other chromosomal abnormalities is most often linked to an older woman's older eggs. Women are born with a lifetime supply of eggs that gradually age along with her. That said, because an estimated minimum 25% of Down syndrome cases and other chromosomal abnormalities are the result of a defect in an older dad's sperm, and because older moms are often married to older dads, it's not always clear whether it's mom's age or dad's age that's implicated. A handful of other pregnancy risks increase slightly with age. One may not sound like a risk at all, but a benefit. Older moms are more likely to conceive twins, even if they've conceived naturally, thanks to an age-related predisposition to releasing more than one egg at a time. In general, increasing age also increases the risk of miscarriage because of an older mom's older eggs, preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, and preterm labor. Labor and delivery, on average, are longer and slightly more likely to be complicated, often because the pregnancy is higher risk to begin with C-section rates higher in older moms, too. But even though the risks of pregnancy at your age are slightly elevated, they are still low. And of course, they're nothing when compared to the reward you're eagerly anticipating. Best of all, pregnancy complications that are more common in older moms can sometimes be prevented, and if not, they can usually be well controlled. The right combination of medical management and medications can help forestall preterm labor, and breakthroughs continue to decrease risks in the birthing room. And though Down syndrome isn't preventable, it can be identified in utero through a variety of screening and diagnostic tests. Better still, today's essentially non-invasive first trimester screenings, which are recommended for all pregnant women, regardless of age, so don't worry, Mama, you're not being picked on, are much more accurate than in the past. moms who pass these screens don't necessarily have to proceed to more invasive diagnostic tests like amnio or CVS, as was once routine, even if they've passed their 35th birthday. This saves time, money, and most important, stress. But as much as obstetrical science can do to help you have a safe pregnancy and delivery and a healthy baby, it's nothing compared to what you can do yourself through exercise, eating well, sensible weight gain, and regular prenatal care. Just being older doesn't necessarily put you in a high-risk category, but an accumulation of many individual risks can. Eliminate or minimize as many risk factors as you can, and you'll be able to take years off your pregnancy profile, making your chances of delivering a healthy baby virtually as good as those of a younger mother. Yes, maybe even better. So relax, enjoy your pregnancy, and be reassured. There's never been a better time to be over 35 and expecting a baby.
Not for dads only. Happy, expectant families come in all packages. Maybe you're two mommies expecting a baby that one of you is carrying, or two daddies expecting a surrogate or planning an open adoption, and you'd both like to stay emotionally and physically connected to the woman who's expecting your precious bundle. Or maybe you're a single mom without an involved or traditional partner, but with friends and family standing by to provide the support he otherwise might. No matter what family package you're coming to parenthood with, this entire book is for you.
For dads. Older dads. Throughout most of history, it was believed that a father's responsibility in the reproductive process was limited to fertilization. Only during the 20th century, too late to help those queens who lost their heads for failing to produce a male heir, was it discovered that a father's sperm holds the deciding genetic vote in determining his child's gender. And only in the last few decades have researchers started realizing that an older father's sperm might also contribute increased risks for his baby, too. Like the older mother's eggs, the older father's spermatocytes, undeveloped sperm, have had longer exposure to environmental hazards and might be more likely to contain altered or damaged genes or chromosomes. What does that mean for an older dad's baby-to-be? Researchers have found that, regardless of the mom's age, a couple's risk of miscarriage increases as the dad's age increases, as does the incidence of Down syndrome once he's over 50 or 55. Again, no matter what mom's age. There also seems to be a somewhat increased risk of autism or mental health issues when a dad is over age 40. Wondering whether your older age will mean more diagnostic tests for your partner and your baby? Genetic counselors don't recommend invasive tests like amnio or CVS based only on a dad's age. And happily, the screening tests that are offered routinely to every mom-to-be, no matter how old she or her partner is, can rule out most chromosomal problems. The bottom line, if you're an older dad, as it is for older moms, the risks are very small, and the benefits of having a baby at the time in your life that's right for you are clearly great. Really, really great. So relax and enjoy this pregnancy adventure together. It'll be worth the wait.
Genetic screening.
I keep wondering if I might have a genetic problem that I don't know about. Should I get genetic screening?
Just about everyone carries a gene for at least one genetic disorder, even if it has never shown up in family history. But fortunately, because most disorders require a matched pair of genes, one from mom and one from dad, they're not likely to show up in their children. One or both parents can be tested for some of these disorders before, which is preferable, or during pregnancy, thanks to genetic testing. In most cases, testing is recommended for one parent. Testing for the second parent becomes necessary only if the first tests positive. Official recommendations on who should be tested and for what have been, until recently, based on ethnic or geographical background and limited to just a few disorders. For example, Jewish couples whose ancestors come from Eastern Europe, Ashkenazi, should be tested for Tay-Sachs, Canavan disease, and possibly for other disorders, Contact victorcenters.org or jscreen.org to learn more. Tay-Sachs has also been noted in other ethnic groups, including Southern Louisiana Cajuns, French Canadians, and the Pennsylvania Dutch. So getting tested is something to consider if your family has these roots. African American couples should be tested for the sickle cell anemia trait, and those of Mediterranean and Asian descent for thalassemia, a hereditary form of anemia. But because it's harder and harder to assign a single ethnic or geographical profile to anyone in today's multi-ethnic and far-flung society, the basis for these recommendations has become far less reliable. Case in point, while Caucasians of European descent have long been told of the importance of testing for cystic fibrosis, CF, since they have about a 1 in 25 chance of being a carrier of the condition, blended backgrounds have expanded the pool of carriers. As a result, the guidelines for CF screening have expanded too. It's now recommended that all couples, regardless of their ethnicity, be screened for CF. Should the guidelines for screening genetic disorders be expanded even further? Many believe so. And now, new advances in genetic testing are enabling all couples, regardless of their ethnic or geographical profile, to test for a broad array of genetic conditions before conceiving. Such so-called expanded carrier screening can screen for the carrier gene of more than 300 diseases, and it gives you the power of knowing whether you and your partner are at risk of passing along any of these genetic conditions to a baby you conceive together. If you both test positive as carriers for a condition, again, no need to test dad if mom tests negative, further genetic counseling and testing can be used to screen your baby or future babies for the condition. What's more, knowing in advance that they carry a significant risk of having a baby with a genetic disorder gives couples the choice of using new reproductive techniques like IVF with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to screen embryos for the diseases before implantation, or to consider sperm donation or other non-traditional routes to starting a family. While many experts are calling for guidelines that would make expanded carrier screening routine for all couples, ACOG isn't yet on board with that position. For now, they recommend that expanded carrier screening be done mainly on the basis of family history and ethnicity, as unreliable as self-reporting of ethnicity might be, with routine screening limited to the cystic fibrosis gene. Even so, ACOG and the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics, ACMG, agree that all couples should be offered the option of having carrier screening, if they choose, before they start trying to conceive. But to reduce the potential emotional downside of screening, experts recommend that it be accompanied by counseling with an OB or geneticist who can explain exactly which disorders the expanded carrier screening panels test for, so couples can opt out of receiving test results that they may not want to know about. ACMG adds that the carrier screen should test only for disorders that would be relevant for reproductive decision-making and not include disorders that are adult onset. Some of the conditions in the 300 disease carrier screen are only adult onset, unless the couple provides specific consent to screen for them all. The best way to decide how to approach genetic screening, regardless of the current recommendations, is to talk it over with your practitioner. That way, you and your partner can decide what's best for you and your soon-to-be growing family.
My partner and I didn't have genetic testing done before pregnancy. Should we see a genetic counselor now?
Since most couples are, happily, at such low risk for passing along a genetic disorder, most don't need to see a genetic counselor, and chances are you're in that majority. To ease your mind, talk over your specific situation with your prenatal practitioner and see whether you'll need to take genetic counseling to the next level. Usually, referral to a genetic counselor or a maternal fetal medicine specialist is limited to those who need extra expertise. Couples whose blood tests and or expanded carrier screen show that they are carriers of a genetic disorder that they might pass on to their children. Couples who have already had one or more children with genetic birth defects. couples who have experienced two or more consecutive miscarriages, couples in which the woman is over age 35 and or the man is over age 40, couples who know of a hereditary disorder on any branch of either of their family trees. In some cases, as with cystic fibrosis or certain thalassemias, DNA testing of the parents before pregnancy makes interpreting later testing of the fetus much easier. Couples in which one partner, or their parent, or sibling, or older child, has a congenital defect, such as congenital heart disease. Pregnant women who have had a positive screening test for a chromosomal defect. Closely related couples, since the risk of a genetic disease in offspring is greatest when parents are close relatives. For example, 1 in 8 for first cousins. The best time to see a genetic counselor and to consider expanded screening is before getting pregnant. A genetic counselor is trained to give couples the odds of their having a healthy baby based on their genetic profiles and can guide them in deciding whether or not to have children. But it's not too late, even after pregnancy is confirmed. The counselor can suggest appropriate prenatal testing based on the couple's genetic profile. And if testing uncovers a serious defect in the fetus, a genetic counselor can outline for the expectant parents all the options available and help them decide how to proceed. Genetic counseling has helped countless high-risk couples avoid the heartbreak of giving birth to children with serious problems while helping them realize their dreams of having completely healthy babies.
Immunizations in pregnancy. Since just about all vaccine-preventable diseases can cause pregnancy problems, being up to date on your immunizations is especially important when you're expecting. Most immunizations using live viruses are not recommended during pregnancy, including the MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella, and varicella, chickenpox vaccines, which is why it's smart to catch up on these as necessary before conceiving. Other vaccines, according to the CDC, shouldn't be given routinely, but can be given if they're needed. These include the hepatitis A and pneumococcal vaccines. You also can be immunized safely against hepatitis B when you're expecting. In the must-have department during pregnancy, the CDC recommends that every woman who is pregnant during flu season, generally October through April, receive a flu vaccine, and that every pregnant woman get the Tdap vaccine, which protects the baby from diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, between 27 and 36 weeks of pregnancy. For more information on vaccines, check with your practitioner. Uninsured mama? Having a baby these days can definitely be an expensive proposition, and that's before you even purchase onesie number one. Still, no expectant mother needs to go through pregnancy and childbirth without the prenatal care she and her baby need. And luckily, there are ways to get that care. Affordable Care Act, ACA. The ACA requires private insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions, including pregnancy. If your employer or your spouse's doesn't offer insurance or you're unemployed, you may be able to apply for a plan through the health insurance marketplace. However, you must enroll during the open enrollment period, which happens on an annual basis, unless you're eligible for special enrollment for a qualifying life event. Pregnancy itself is not considered a qualifying life event, but marriage, divorce, and moving count, and you can usually add the baby to your coverage or change to coverage that also covers your baby within 60 days of the birth, even outside the open enrollment period. Find out more, including how to get in touch with a local marketplace representative, at healthcare.gov. Medicaid and CHIP. Even if you haven't qualified in the past, many states increase their income eligibility levels during pregnancy to help more pregnant women get coverage through Medicaid. The Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF.org, has a list of each state's income limits, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services also has a useful fact sheet, Medicaid.gov. Or call your local health insurance marketplace representative at 800-318-2596 to ask whether you're eligible. In all states, the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, provides low-cost health coverage to children in families that earn too much money to qualify for Medicaid. In some states, CHIP also covers pregnant women. To find out if you're eligible for CHIP's prenatal coverage, fill out your state's marketplace application or visit insurekidsnow.gov. COBRA. If you or your spouse are recently unemployed and previously had health insurance, you may be able to get coverage for up to 36 months through a program called COBRA. Unfortunately, COBRA premiums are usually very high since they don't include employer contributions. But it may be a good compromise until you or your spouse gets a new job with insurance benefits. Contact your former employer's Human Resources Department for more information. Before you commit to COBRA, it may be worth comparing the costs and benefits of it against a plan through the health insurance marketplace if you're within an open enrollment period or you qualify for special enrollment. Marketplace coverage can be less expensive than the COBRA option, especially if you're eligible for subsidies under the ACA. Your parents. Under the ACA, if you're under 26 years old and one of your parents has a health plan, they should be able to add you as a dependent, even if you don't live with them, whether you're married or not, and regardless of whether they've declared you as a dependent on their taxes. The catch? You may have to wait for an open enrollment period to be added, and many healthcare plans do not cover maternity services for dependents. Clinics. If you can't afford any health plan and don't qualify for coverage through Medicaid and CHIP, you may be able to get low-cost healthcare at a nearby community health center or clinic. Find one at findahealthcenter.hrsa.gov or call 800-311-BABY. Discounts. If you've investigated the other insurance options and it turns out you still have to pay out of pocket for your care, call your healthcare providers. They may be able to help. Many doctors and hospitals will give you a discount, sometimes as much as 20 or 30% if you're paying cash. They also usually offer payment plans that give you the option of paying the bill over time, but check to see if they charge interest for this arrangement. Check, too, before signing up for a healthcare financing credit card offered by a medical practice to cover the cost. You could pay interest rates of 20% or higher. Another possibility? Healthcare discount services or discount cards, which negotiate price cuts on healthcare services for a monthly fee. Do read the fine print to make sure your healthcare providers and services are covered and that there are no hidden fees. Other ways to save if you're paying out of pocket. If you're healthy, at low risk for complications, and want an unmedicated childbirth for your bundle of joy, you can save a bundle by delivering at a birthing center instead of a hospital. At a birthing center, the average unmedicated vaginal birth with no complications usually costs less than what a hospital charges. Choosing a midwife will save you more too, even if you opt for a hospital delivery. Pregnancy and the single mom. Are you a single mom-to-be? Just because you don't have a partner doesn't mean you have to go it alone during pregnancy. The kind of support you'll need, and every mom needs, can come from sources other than a partner. A friend or a relative you feel close to and comfortable with can step in to hold your hand emotionally and physically throughout pregnancy. That person can, in many ways, play the partner role during the 9 months and beyond, accompanying you to prenatal visits and childbirth education classes, lending an ear and a shoulder, helping you get both your home and life ready for the new arrival, and acting as a coach, cheerleader, supporter, and overall advocate during labor and delivery. And since no one will know better what you're going through than another single mom, you might also consider joining or starting a support group for single mothers or finding an online support group. Check out the Single Moms message board at whattoexpect.com. Also, consider adding a doula to your birth team as well as to your postpartum team. Or if the option is open locally, choose a centering pregnancy program for your prenatal care, since the group approach means you're never alone at checkups. Just as happy to go it alone, and maybe even happier? That's an option some single moms take happily. All about prenatal diagnosis.
Is it a boy or a girl? Will baby have blonde hair or brown, green eyes or blue, mom's mouth and dad's dimples? Dad's musical talent and Mom's knack for numbers? Or the other way around? Babies definitely keep their parents guessing and placing friendly bets long before they actually arrive, sometimes before they're conceived. But the one question that expectant parents wonder about the most is also the one they hesitate most to talk about or even think about. Will my baby be healthy? Time was that question could only be answered after birth. Today, it can be answered as early as the first trimester through a very wide variety of prenatal screening and diagnostic tests. What screens can you expect to have during your 40 weeks? Will diagnostic tests be part of your pregnancy plan? With a field ever growing and recommendations ever changing, you'll need to rely on your practitioner to help guide you to the options that are right for you and your pregnancy. Screening tests. Most expectant moms, even those considered at low risk of having a baby with a defect, undergo several screening tests during their 40 weeks. That's because screening tests are non-invasive and increasingly accurate. They pose no risk to mom, except maybe to your nerves, or baby, but can provide a lot of beneficial reassurance. An easy way to breathe easy. Prenatal screening tests use a blood draw and/or ultrasound to identify whether you're at an increased risk of having a baby with a genetic disorder, like Down syndrome, or a neural tube defect, like spina bifida. They can't diagnose such conditions, only a diagnostic test can do that, but they can determine the likelihood that your baby is affected with anywhere from 80 to 99% accuracy. Here's what you need to know about each of them. Non-invasive prenatal screening after 9 weeks. Did you know that pieces of your baby's DNA circulate in your bloodstream? The non-invasive prenatal screening test, NIPT or NIPS, involves a simple blood screening anytime after 9 weeks that analyzes DNA. It's called cell-free fetal DNA or cfDNA. To pinpoint baby's risk for a number of genetic disorders, including Down syndrome. NIPT is a screening test, which means it can only tell you the likelihood of your baby having a disorder, with the added bonus of letting you know your baby's sex, that is, if you want to find out, not if your baby definitely has or doesn't have a disorder. The companies that perform these new screening tests say that NIPT creates far fewer false positives than standard blood screenings. The results can help you and your practitioner decide next steps, including whether invasive diagnostic tests, which are even more precise but carry some risk, are worth that risk. Because NIPT involves only a quick blood draw with a needle and syringe, all you'll need to do is offer up your arm at the practitioner's office or a lab, so it's perfectly safe for you and your baby. Your sample is then sent off to a lab, which will check the DNA in your blood for signs of an elevated risk of abnormalities. Once the results of your NIPT are back, your practitioner will likely pair them with the results of your first trimester ultrasound or nuchal translucency screening to determine whether more testing is needed. If it's positive, your practitioner will recommend following up with amniocentesis or CVS to confirm the result and check for other problems NIPT can't detect, such as neural tube defects. Because NIPT is relatively new, it's not FDA approved. Currently, ACOG recommends that NIPT be offered only to women at higher risk of carrying a baby with a chromosomal abnormality, such as moms-to-be who are 35 or older, or those who have previously had a child with a genetic disorder or have a family history of a genetic disorder, not to low-risk women. NIPT is not recommended at all for women carrying multiples or those who are using a donor egg. Before you schedule NIPT, check with your insurance plan to find out if the test is fully covered. Most plans do cover it, and if not, what it will cost you. Nuchal translucency screening, 10 to 13 weeks. The nuchal translucency NT screening test, basically a specialized ultrasound, lets you know if you're at an increased risk for having a baby with with a chromosomal problem, such as Down syndrome. Unlike diagnostic tests, however, the NT screening can't give you a definitive answer about whether your baby has a genetic abnormality. Instead, it gives you the statistical likelihood of one. With that information in hand, you and your practitioner can then decide if further, more invasive but conclusive diagnostic testing, such as amniocentesis or CVS, is necessary. What exactly does NT measure? It focuses on a small, clear space in the tissue at the back of a growing baby's neck called the nuchal fold. Experts have found that this spot tends to accumulate fluid and, as a result, expands in size in babies who have genetic abnormalities, like Down syndrome, caused by an extra copy of chromosome 21, one of the 23 pairs of chromosomes that contain a human's genetic code. Trisomy 18, an extra copy of chromosome 18, and trisomy 13, an extra number 13 chromosome. NT screening, which must be performed between 10 and 13 weeks of pregnancy, after that the tissue gets so thick that it's no longer translucent, making test results inconclusive, is done with a highly sensitive ultrasound machine, but like a standard ultrasound, is considered safe. A sonographer will first measure your baby to confirm his or her gestational age before zooming in on the nuchal fold and measuring its thickness on the screen. Those measurements, plus your age and baby's gestational age, will be entered into an equation that calculates the probability of a chromosomal abnormality. An NT screen is often part of routine prenatal testing during the first trimester and recommended for all women. While it's widely available, some areas, especially rural ones, may not have the machine and technicians with the expertise to perform the procedure. Because increased NT measurements are also associated with fetal heart defects, your practitioner might suggest a fetal echocardiogram at around 20 weeks to screen for heart defects if your levels are high. Increased NT measurements may also be linked to a very slightly higher risk of preterm birth, so you may be monitored for that as well if your NT results are high. Combined screening, 11 to 14 weeks. Because NT results by themselves have an accuracy rate of just 70 to 75%, meaning that the test misses 25 to 30% of babies with Down syndrome, your practitioner might offer what's referred to as a combined screening, in which the NT ultrasound results are combined with one or two blood tests that measure and compare your levels of two hormones, HCG and PAPPA, pregnancy-associated plasma protein A, which are produced by the fetus and passed into the mother's bloodstream. By combining these two blood tests with the NT screening, the accuracy of detection rates for Down syndrome rises dramatically to between 83 and 92%. If your combined screening test shows that your baby may be at an increased risk of having a chromosomal defect, a test such as CVS or amniocentesis will be offered. If the screening test doesn't show an increased risk, your practitioner might recommend that you take the integrated screening test in the second trimester to rule out neural tube defects as well. Remember, this screen doesn't directly test for chromosomal problems, and it can't diagnose a specific condition. Rather, the results provide your baby's statistical likelihood of having a problem. An abnormal result on the combined screening test definitely doesn't mean that your baby has a chromosomal problem, just that he or she has an increased risk of having one, making follow-up diagnostic testing advisable. In fact, most women who have an abnormal result on their screening test go on to have a perfectly normal baby. At the same time, a normal result isn't an absolute guarantee that your baby is normal, but it does mean that it is extremely unlikely that your baby has a chromosomal defect. Integrated screening. First and second trimesters. Another screening test option that you may be offered combines measurements of the hormone PAPPA and possibly NT from the first trimester with the measurements of four hormones tested for in the second trimester quad screening, Combining the first and second trimester measurements gives a bit more sensitivity to the screening. Quad screening, 14 to 22 weeks. Quad screening is a blood test that measures the level of four substances produced by the fetus and passed into the mother's bloodstream: alpha-fetoprotein, AFP, HCG, estriol, and inhibin A. High levels of AFP may suggest the possibility, but by no means the probability, that a baby is at higher risk for a neural tube defect. Low levels of AFP and abnormal levels of the other markers may indicate that the developing baby may be at higher risk for chromosomal abnormality, such as Down syndrome. The quad screening, like all screening tests, can't diagnose a birth defect. It can only indicate a higher risk. Any abnormal result simply means that follow-up testing is needed. Your doctor may recommend a quad screen instead of NIPT screening because NIPT may not be available in your area and may not be covered by your insurance. This screening is also less accurate than the NT screen combined with first trimester blood work, so it's usually recommended only for moms-to-be who are already in their second trimester. When an abnormality actually exists, the quad screen is pretty good at detecting an increased risk of it. Picking it up in approximately 85% of neural tube defect cases, nearly 80% of Down syndrome cases, and 80% of trisomy 18 cases. But the false positive rate for the independent quad screen is very high. Only one or two out of 50 women with abnormal readings eventually prove to have an affected fetus. In all the rest, further testing shows that no abnormality exists after all. Sometimes it turns out that hormone levels tested outside the normal range because there's more than one baby. Other times, it's because the EDD is off. The fetus is either a few weeks older or younger than expected. And still other times, it's because the test results were inaccurate or misinterpreted. If you get a positive result, you're carrying a single baby, and your ultrasound shows your dates are correct, you'll be offered amniocentesis as a follow-up. But before you consider taking this or any action on the basis of a quad screening, be sure a genetic counselor or doctor experienced in interpreting these types of screening tests has evaluated and verified the results. One other thing to consider when getting your quad screening results. Studies indicate that women who receive abnormal results on their quad screen but receive normal results on follow-up testing, such as amniocentesis, may still be at a very slightly increased risk of certain pregnancy complications, such as a small for gestational age baby, preterm delivery, or preeclampsia. Talk to your practitioner about whether this might apply to you. Level 2 ultrasound, 18 to 22 weeks. Even if you had an ultrasound in your first trimester to date your pregnancy, you'll probably also get a screening ultrasound in your second trimester. This level 2 scan, also called an anatomy scan, is much more detailed and focuses closely on fetal anatomy to make sure everything is growing and developing as it should. It can also be a lot more fun to look at because it gives a far clearer picture of your baby-to-be than that first fuzzy one you got way back in trimester 1. A level 2 scan also checks for hard and soft markers, characteristics that may indicate an increased risk of a chromosomal abnormality. Important to know before you head in for your scan, very few babies showing soft markers such as choroid plexus cysts, echogenic foci, or pyelectasia, to name an unpronounceable few, end up having an abnormality. In fact, those markers are spotted on as many as 11 to 17% of all healthy babies. Good reason not to worry if one is spotted on your baby scan. Your practitioner will let you know whether any follow-up testing is necessary. It often isn't. As with any ultrasound, a wand, transducer, is placed on your belly that sends sound waves through your body. The waves bounce off internal organs and fluids, and the computer converts those echoes into a two-dimensional image, or a cross-sectional view, of the fetus on a screen. Sometimes 3D or even 4D technology is used instead of 2D. During your level 2 ultrasound, you may be able to spot your baby's beating heart, the curve of the spine, and the face, arms, and legs. You may even catch sight of your baby sucking a thumb. Usually the genitals can be seen and the sex determined, although with less than 100% reliability, and depending on baby's cooperation. If you'd like to keep the sex a surprise until delivery, make sure you let your practitioner or technician know this in advance.
Knowing the negatives of false positives. You undergo screening tests for the reassurance you hope they'll provide, and ultimately the results are usually reassuring. But it's important to start off the screening process with an open discussion with your practitioner so you can learn about the negatives of false positives, test results that come back positive for an increased risk of a disorder when in fact baby's just fine, what it really means if you get a positive result, which tests have a high rate of false positives, like the quad screen or the NT alone, and which tests have a lower rate of false positives, like NIPT. What you'll hear is that more than 90% of moms who get a positive screen will end up having perfectly normal and healthy babies. Talk about positive.
Diagnostic tests. While just about every expectant mom will sign up for screening tests, going a step further to definitive diagnostic tests isn't for everyone. Many parents, particularly those whose screening tests come back negative, can continue to play the waiting game with the happy assurance that the chances are overwhelming that their babies will arrive completely healthy. But if you receive a positive result on a screening test, your practitioner may recommend following up with a diagnostic test to see if an abnormality actually exists, which it most often doesn't. Other reasons why a mom-to-be might consider having prenatal diagnostic testing: having a family history of and or being a carrier of a genetic condition, having had a baby with a birth defect, or having been exposed to an infection or substance that could possibly cause harm to a developing baby. Unlike screenings, diagnostic tests like chorionic villus sampling, or CVS, and amniocentesis, amnio, analyze the genetic material in cells collected from baby's placenta or amniotic fluid. These tests are more accurate in detecting chromosomal abnormalities, like Down syndrome, and in the case of amnio, neural tube defects, because they directly test for problems, not just signs that possibly point to problems. You might want to consider speaking to a genetic counselor before taking diagnostic tests, just so you are armed with accurate information going in.
Mistakes happen. As far as prenatal diagnosis has come, it's still important to remember that it's far from infallible. Mistakes happen, even in the best labs and facilities, even with the most skilled professionals wielding the most high-tech equipment, with false positives being much more common than false negatives. That's why further testing and/or consultation with additional professionals should always be used to confirm a result that indicates there is something wrong with the fetus. And if that's confirmed, what the prognosis for your baby will be.
Why go through diagnostic testing if there's some risk involved? The best reason is the reassurance it usually brings. Most of the time, diagnostic tests diagnose a perfectly healthy baby, which means that mom and dad can stop worrying and start enjoying their pregnancy. Chorionic villus sampling, 10 to 13 weeks. CVS is a first trimester prenatal diagnostic test that involves taking a small tissue sample from the finger-like projections of the placenta called the chorionic villi and testing the sample to detect chromosomal abnormalities. Because CVS is performed in the first trimester, it can give results, and most often reassurance, earlier in pregnancy than amniocentesis, which is usually performed after the 16th week. CVS can detect with 98% accuracy a number of disorders, including Down syndrome, Tay-Sachs disease, sickle cell anemia, and most types of cystic fibrosis. CVS can't test for neural tube and other anatomical defects. Testing for specific genetic diseases, other than Down syndrome, is usually done only when there is a family history of the disease or the parents are known to be carriers. CVS is most often performed by a maternal-fetal medicine specialist in an ultrasound suite. Depending on the location of the placenta, the sample of cells is taken via the vagina and cervix, transcervical CVS, or via a needle inserted in the abdominal wall, transabdominal CVS. Neither method is entirely pain-free, and the discomfort can range from very mild to moderate. Some women experience cramping, similar to menstrual cramps, when the sample is taken. Both methods take about 30 minutes, start to finish, though the actual withdrawal of cells takes no more than a minute or two. In the transcervical procedure, you'll lie on your back with your feet in stirrups while a long, thin tube is inserted through your vagina into your uterus. Guided by ultrasound imaging, the doctor positions the tube between the uterine lining and the chorion, the fetal membrane that will eventually form the fetal side of the placenta. A sample of the chorionic villi is then snipped or suctioned off for diagnostic study. In the transabdominal procedure, you'll also lie flat, tummy up. Ultrasound is used to determine the location of the placenta and to view the uterine walls. Then, with continued ultrasound guidance, a needle is inserted through your abdomen and the uterine wall to the edge of the placenta, and the cells to be studied are drawn up through the needle. Because the chorionic villi are of fetal origin, examining them can give a clear picture of the genetic makeup of the fetus. Test results are available in 1 to 2 weeks. CVS is safe and reliable. The procedure carries a miscarriage rate equal to that of amnio, which is less than 0.5%. Choosing a testing center with a good safety record and waiting until after the 10th week can further reduce the risk associated with the procedure. Some vaginal bleeding can occur after CVS and shouldn't be cause for concern, though it should be reported. You should also let your doctor know if the bleeding lasts for 3 days or longer. Since there is a very slight risk of infection with CVS, report any fever that occurs in the first few days after the procedure. If you're Rh negative, you'll be given an injection of Rh immune globulin, Rogam, after the CVS to be sure the procedure doesn't result in Rh problems later on.
It's a surprise. Diagnostic testing and some screening tests like NIPT or second trimester ultrasound can determine whether your bundle of joy is a boy or a girl. But unless it's a necessary part of the diagnosis, you'll have the option of either learning baby's sex when you receive the testing results, or when you cut into a pink or blue cake at the gender reveal party, or waiting to find out the old-fashioned way in the birthing room. Just make sure your practitioner knows about your decision ahead of time so your surprise won't be inadvertently spoiled.
Amniocentesis, 16 to 20 weeks. In this diagnostic test, which is usually done between weeks 16 and 18 of pregnancy, a long, thin, hollow needle is inserted through your abdomen, through the wall of the uterus, and into the fluid-filled amniotic sac. Ultrasound is done at the same time so your baby doesn't get accidentally poked by the needle. You'll feel the prick and might experience some mild pain and cramping. About 1 to 2 tablespoons of the fluid are drawn out. Don't worry, it will be quickly replenished and sent to the lab for analysis. The fluid contains cells that your baby has sloughed off, plus chemicals. By analyzing this baby brew, your practitioner can assess the health of your fetus and look for certain medical conditions, such as Down syndrome, caused by abnormalities in the chromosomes. The entire procedure, including prep time and ultrasound, will usually take about 30 minutes, start to finish, though the actual withdrawal of amniotic fluid takes no more than a minute or two. If you're Rh negative, you'll be given an injection of Rh immune globulin, Rogam, after the amniocentesis to be sure the procedure does not result in Rh problems. Amnio and CVS diagnose nearly all chromosomal disorders, including Down syndrome, with 99% accuracy, with at least 90% accuracy for several hundred other genetic diseases, such as sickle cell anemia, when they're specifically checked for. It does not, however, detect every kind of abnormality, including cleft lip or palate, and it can't determine the severity of the problem. Unlike CVS, Amnio can also rule out neural tube defects, such as spina bifida. Amnio is usually recommended if you're at high risk of certain abnormalities, had a previous child with a birth defect, have a family history of genetic conditions, unless you've been screened and found that you're not a carrier, and/or have received a positive result on a screening like NT, NIPT, combined screen, or quad screen, and you've missed the first trimester window for CVS or opted not to get a CVS because that test can't detect neural tube defects. Test results are usually back in 10 to 14 days. Although most of the conditions detected by amniocentesis can't be cured, the test can let parents know about their baby's abnormality in advance. This gives them time to become informed about a condition, as well as make decisions about their baby's future health care or make the difficult decision to not continue the pregnancy. The news is rarely bad, however. More than 95% of the time, Amnio will find nothing but a healthy baby. And if you'd like to know the sex of your baby, Amnio will give you that news too. After the procedure, you'll be able to drive yourself home. Some doctors recommend you have someone else drive you just to be on the safe side. And you'll probably be told to rest in bed for a few hours to a full 24 hours. You'll need to avoid sex, heavy lifting, strenuous exercise, and flying for the next 3 days. You might experience minor cramping, but if the cramps become severe or persistent, call your practitioner. Also call if you notice leaking amniotic fluid or spotting, or if you develop a fever. Complications from amnio are rare, but you should discuss them with your practitioner when considering the procedure.
If a problem is found. In the vast majority of cases, prenatal diagnosis yields the results that parents hope for, that all is well with their baby-to-be. But when the news isn't happy, when something does turn out to be wrong, the information provided by such a heartbreaking diagnosis can still be valuable to parents. Teamed with expert genetic counseling, it can be used to make vital decisions about this and future pregnancies. Following positive results on definitive diagnostic testing, you'll get, or you should ask for, a referral to experts, such as genetic counselor and/or a doctor specializing in your baby's condition, so you can learn about your options, including whether or not you might want to repeat the testing just to be sure the diagnosis is correct. You can also do your own research. After all, the more you know about your baby's condition and what you're facing as a family, the better prepared you can be, both emotionally and practically, for what lies ahead, whether it's receiving a child with special needs or coping with the inevitable loss of a baby. You'll also be able to begin working through the reactions, denial, resentment, guilt, that can come with discovering that your dreams of a perfectly healthy baby aren't coming true. Joining a condition-specific support group, even one online, can help make coping somewhat easier, providing both answers and community. Depending on your baby's condition, it may be recommended that you give birth at a specialized hospital if possible. A specialized birth facility for labor and delivery can better address your specific needs or recommend medical interventions that, if performed immediately after birth, can improve your baby's quality of life. What's more, many of the hospitals that cater to high-risk births already have support groups in their community outreach programs, as well as specialized NICUs, neonatal intensive care units, that can provide the best care for your baby if necessary. Lining up a pediatrician with specialized training while you're still pregnant guarantees care specific to your little one's condition from the day he or she arrives. In some cases, an abnormality can be addressed prenatally. If your baby has a serious heart condition or spina bifida, for example, you may be able to opt for a prenatal procedure to correct it, if necessary, rather than waiting until after your baby is born. be sure to ask your practitioner whether your baby is a candidate for prenatal surgery. Early interventions, such as therapy and other medical treatment, performed as soon as baby is born, may also go a long way toward improving the prognosis for your little one, as well as his or her quality of life. If you've been told your baby likely won't make it to term, since a fetus with certain chromosome disorders often won't survive a pregnancy, or may not live very long after birth, it may be possible to donate one or more healthy organs to an infant in need. Some parents find that this provides some consolation for their own loss. A maternal fetal specialist or neonatologist may be able to provide helpful information in such a situation and can help you prepare physically and emotionally for it. There are also numerous hospitals, hospices, and clinics that provide perinatal hospice and palliative care support for families who wish to continue their pregnancies with babies who likely will not live long after birth. If testing suggests a defect that will be fatal or extremely disabling, and retesting and interpretation by a genetic counselor confirms the diagnosis, some parents may make the agonizing decision in consultation with their practitioners or other experts to terminate the pregnancy. If you do, allow yourself time and space to grieve in the same way that moms-to-be who experience any kind of pregnancy loss need to. Chapter 3. Your Pregnancy Lifestyle.
Of course, you're expecting to make some adjustments in your everyday life now that you're expecting. Goodbye baby tease, hello baby on board tease. But you might also be wondering just how drastically your lifestyle will have to change now that you're living for two. How about that pre-dinner cocktail? Will it have to wait until post-delivery? Those regular dips in the hot tub, are those washed up too? Can you wipe your bathroom sink with that effective but smelly disinfectant? And what's that you heard about cat litter? Does being pregnant really mean you have to think twice about all those things you've never given a second thought to? From letting your best friend smoke in your living room to zapping your dinner in the microwave? In a few cases, you'll find the answer is an emphatic yes, as in, no wine for me, thanks. But in many others, your expectant self will be able to continue doing business and pleasure as usual, with maybe just a side of caution. Honey, it's your turn to change the cat litter for the next 9 months.
What you may be wondering about, how will my life change during pregnancy?
Working out.
Can I keep up with my regular workout now that I'm pregnant?
Workouts are not only a can-do for most pregnant women, but a definite should-do. In fact, the vast majority of workouts work well with the vast majority of pregnancies, which means you can almost certainly count on continuing your usual routine through your 9 months. Just to be sure, check in with your practitioner for the all-clear on your current workout regimen and ask before beginning a new one. Pregnancy isn't the time to take on an extreme sport. Also remember this mama-to-be mantra. Listen to your body. Don't exercise until you drop or until it hurts. Instead, make moderation your pregnancy workout MO. If you'd like to see any of the illustrations from this chapter, you can download and print out a special PDF from the same Audible page where you purchased your audiobook. Caffeine.
I drink coffee to keep me going all day. Do I have to give up caffeine while I'm pregnant?
No need to surrender your Starbucks card entirely, though you may have to start pulling it out a little less often. Most evidence suggests that drinking up to about 200 milligrams of caffeine a day is perfectly safe for your little bean. What does that break down to exactly? Possibly not as much as you'd hoped. About 12 ounces of brewed coffee, 2 small cups or 1 tall, or about 2 shots of espresso, which means you're good to go and fuel your get up to go if you're a light to moderate coffee drinker. But you'll have to reassess your intake if you've got a more serious Java Jones. For instance, you're a member in good standing of the 5-shot Americano Club. Why go so low? Well, for one thing, you share that coffee, like everything you eat and drink when you're expecting, with your baby. Caffeine, found most famously, abundantly, and arguably deliciously in coffee, but also available in other foods and beverages, does cross the placenta, though to what extent and at what dose it affects the fetus is not completely clear. The latest information indicates that heavier caffeine intake early in pregnancy slightly increases the risk of miscarriage. But there's more to the caffeine story, at least when you overdo the stuff. Sure, caffeine has impressive pick-me-up powers, but in large doses, it can block the absorption of iron. It can also act as a diuretic, causing calcium and other key pregnancy nutrients to be washed out of your system before they can be thoroughly absorbed, not to mention increasing urinary frequency, something you've likely found is plenty frequent enough. It can be irritating to your bladder too, which is already under plenty of pressure, literally, during pregnancy. Need more motivation for cutting down? Too much caffeine mixed with pregnancy hormones can make an especially intense brew for many expectant moms, the perfect storm for even more volatile mood swings. It can also prevent you from getting the rest your body's craving more than ever, especially if you drink it after noon. Caffeine can stay in your system, keeping your engine revved for at least 8 hours. Different practitioners have different recommendations on caffeine consumption, so check in with yours for a bottom line on your coffee quota. When calculating your daily intake, keep in mind that it's not necessarily as easy as counting cups, especially because those cups vary so much in size and strength. Caffeine isn't found just in coffee, it's also in caffeinated soft drinks. Too many Mountain Dews are a mountain don't. Coffee ice cream and yogurt, many varieties of tea, energy bars and drinks, and chocolate. The darker the chocolate, the more caffeine it packs. You'll need to know, too, that dark brews poured at coffee bars contain far more caffeine than homemade. Likewise, instant coffee contains less than drip does. How do you cut down on a hefty caffeine habit or cut it out altogether if you choose? That depends on what's in the caffeine for you. If it's a part of your day or many parts of your day you're not excited about parting with, there's no need to. Just make your morning Joe regular and your afternoons decaf. Or order your latte with mostly decaf shots instead of regular, or with less espresso and more milk. You'll get a bigger calcium bonus anyway. If it's the lift you crave and that your body has become accustomed to, cutting back will be a taller order. Make that a venti order. As any coffee lover is well aware, it's one thing to be motivated to cut back on or kick caffeine altogether, and another thing to do it. Caffeine is addictive. That's where the craving comes from. And quitting or even cutting way back on a heavy habit comes with its own set of withdrawal symptoms, including headache, irritability, fatigue, and lethargy. That's why it's a good idea to ease off heavy consumption gradually. Try cutting back a cup at a time and give yourself a few days to adjust to the lower dose before cutting back by another cup. Another way to cut back. Take each cup half-calf, gradually going full decaf in more and more cups until your total caffeine consumption is down to the 2 a day or less goal. No matter what's been driving you to the coffee bar, cutting back on or kicking caffeine will be less of a drag if you follow these energizing solutions. Boost your blood sugar to boost your energy. You'll get a longer-lasting boost from snacking on healthy foods often, especially complex carbs and protein, a combo that will give you the lift that keeps on lifting. Get some pregnancy-appropriate exercise every day. Working out will help you work out those caffeine cravings, but it'll also raise the energy roof while releasing those feel-good endorphins. Adding fresh air to the exercise mix will give you an extra energy boost. Get your buzz from Z's. Clocking in the sleep your body needs at night, which will probably be easier to do without all that caffeine keeping you wired, will help you feel more refreshed in the morning, even before you've filled your first mug. Keep an eye on the prize and on your savings. Do the math. Cutting back on visits to the coffee bar means you'll be able to stash cash to use on gearing up for your baby-to-be.
Caffeine counter. How much caffeine do you get per day? It may be more or less than you think, and more or less than that approximate limit of 200 milligrams. Check out this handy list so you can do the math before you belly up to the coffee bar or the chocolate bar. 1 cup brewed coffee, 8 ounces, equals 135 milligrams. 1 cup instant coffee equals 95 milligrams. 1 cup decaf coffee equals 5 to 30 milligrams. 1 shot espresso, or any drink made with 1 shot, equals 90 milligrams. 1 cup tea equals 40 to 60 milligrams. Green tea has less caffeine than black tea. 1 can cola, 12 ounces, equals about 35 milligrams. 1 can diet cola equals 45 milligrams. 1 can Red Bull equals 80 milligrams. 1 ounce milk chocolate equals 6 milligrams. 1 ounce dark chocolate equals 20 milligrams. 1 cup chocolate milk equals 5 milligrams. 1/2 cup coffee ice cream equals 20 to 40 milligrams.
Drinking.
I had a few drinks before I knew I was pregnant. Could that have hurt the baby?
Wouldn't it be nice to get a text from your body the moment sperm and egg meet up? Just wanted to let you know we have a baby on board. Time to trade in that wine for water. But since there's no app for that, at least not yet, many moms-to-be are clueless that baby-making has begun until several weeks into pregnancy, especially if they weren't keeping track of their fertility. And in the meantime, they're apt to have done a thing or two they wouldn't have done if they'd only known. Like having a few times too many, which is why your concern is shared by so many other new moms-to-be. Fortunately, it's a concern that you can cross off your list. There is no evidence that a couple of drinks on a couple of occasions very early in pregnancy, when you didn't even know you were pregnant, can harm a developing embryo. So you and all the other moms who didn't get the message right away can relax. That said, it's definitely time to change your drink order now. Keep listening to find out more.
I've heard that it's okay to have an occasional glass of wine with dinner when you're pregnant. Is that true?
It's been passed around the pregnancy grapevine a lot lately, but there's no research to support that an occasional glass of wine or beer or cocktail is a safe bet when you're expecting. In fact, the Surgeon General, the CDC, ACOG, AAP, and many other experts advise that no amount of alcohol is safe for pregnant women. You can check in with your practitioner for a recommendation. Some practitioners are more lenient when it comes to alcohol in pregnancy, especially that occasional glass of wine sipped with food. Taking a page from medical texts in the UK and many European countries, where light drinking for two is considered acceptable. But here's why the medical consensus in the US comes down so definitively against drinking during pregnancy. First, it's to be on the safe side, which, when you think about it, is always the best side to be on when you have a baby on board. Though nobody knows for sure whether there is a safe limit when it comes to alcohol consumption during pregnancy, or whether that limit would be different in different women and for different babies, it is known that an expectant mom never drinks alone. She shares each glass of wine, each beer, each cocktail equally with her baby. The alcohol enters the fetal bloodstream in about the same concentrations present in the mom-to-be's blood. But it takes the fetus twice as long to eliminate the alcohol from its system. Second, for some moms-to-be, having an occasional drink during pregnancy can be a slippery slope. One mom's sip of wine may be another mom's 12 ounces, making it wiser to just stay away from alcohol altogether. Glass sizes and pours, whether at home or in a restaurant, vary widely too, another good reason to toe the teetotaling line. Certainly more than occasional light drinking is associated with proven serious risks to a developing baby. Passing up a drink during pregnancy is as easily done as said for some women, especially those who develop an aversion to alcohol in early pregnancy that sometimes lingers through delivery. For others, particularly those who are accustomed to unwinding with a beer at the end of the day or to sipping a glass of red with dinner, abstinence may require a concerted effort and include a lifestyle change. If you drink to relax, for example, try substituting other methods of relaxation, music, a bath, prenatal yoga, or meditation or visualization. If drinking is part of your daily ritual that you don't want to give up, try a Virgin Mary, a Bloody Mary without the vodka, at brunch, sparkling juice or non-alcoholic beer at dinner, or a half-juice, half-sparkling water spritzer, served at the usual time in the usual glasses, unless, of course, those look-alike beverages trigger a yen for the real stuff. If your spouse joins you on the wagon, at least while in your company, the ride will be considerably smoother. If you're having trouble giving up alcohol, ask your practitioner for help and for a referral to a program that can help you quit.
Drinking that can devastate. At what point does a drink become one drink too many for a developing fetus? It's hard to put a number on that since every woman and every fetus is different, and the amount of alcohol in different drinks and pours varies. However, drinking heavily throughout pregnancy or binge drinking, having four or more drinks at a time, even occasionally, can result not only in serious obstetrical complications, but in fetal alcohol syndrome. This condition produces babies who are born small for gestational age, with facial deformities and with brain damage, which later shows up as tremors, motor development problems, attention deficits, learning disabilities, lower IQ, and possibly other mental deficiencies. But even drinking moderately throughout pregnancy can increase the risk of miscarriage and stillbirth, as well as the risk of developmental and behavioral problems in a child. The effects of drinking during pregnancy are devastating, permanent, and completely preventable by completely avoiding alcohol. The sooner a drinker stops drinking during pregnancy, the less risk there is to her baby and her pregnancy. If you can't stop drinking, talk to your practitioner and get help right away.
Smoking.
I've been smoking cigarettes for 10 years. Will this hurt my baby?
Happily, there's no clear evidence that any smoking you've done before pregnancy, even if it's been for 10 or more years, will harm the baby you're now busy making. But it is well documented, as well as plastered on cigarette packs, that smoking during pregnancy, particularly beyond the third month, isn't hazardous just to your health, but to your baby's as well. In effect, when a mom smokes, her fetus is confined in a smoke-filled womb. Its heartbeat speeds up, and worst of all, because of insufficient oxygen, it can't grow and thrive as it should. The results can be devastating. Smoking around the time of conception increases the risk of ectopic pregnancy, and continued smoking can increase the risk of a wide variety of pregnancy complications, including abnormal implantation or premature detachment of the placenta, premature rupture of the membranes, and early delivery. There's also strong evidence that a baby's development in utero is adversely and directly affected by mom smoking. The most widespread risks for babies of smokers are low birth weight, shorter length, and smaller head circumference, as well as cleft palate or cleft lip and heart defects. And being born too small is a major cause of newborn illness and death. There are other potential risks as well. Babies of smokers are more likely to die from SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. They are also more prone to apnea, breathing lapses, and in general aren't as healthy at birth as babies of non-smokers. And evidence indicates that on average, these children will suffer long-term physical and intellectual deficits, especially if parents continue to smoke around them. Children of mothers who smoked while pregnant are hospitalized more often in their first year of life and are particularly prone to a lowered immune system, respiratory diseases, ear infections, colic, tuberculosis, food allergies, asthma, short stature, obesity, and problems in school, including attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. They're also more likely to be abnormally aggressive as toddlers, and to have behavioral and psychological problems into adulthood. Other research suggests that daughters born to mothers who smoke during pregnancy are at higher risk of developing gestational diabetes when they become pregnant later in life. Finally, children of moms who smoke during pregnancy are also more likely to grow up to be smokers themselves. The effects of tobacco use, like those of alcohol use, are dose-related. Tobacco use reduces the birth weight of babies in direct proportion to the number of cigarettes smoked, with a pack-a-day smoker 30% more likely to give birth to a low birth weight child than a non-smoker. So cutting down on the number of cigarettes you smoke may help some. But cutting down can be misleading because the smoker often compensates by taking more frequent and deeper puffs and smoking more of each cigarette. This can also happen when a smoker switches to low tar or low nicotine cigarettes. What about e-cigarettes? Despite little research on electronic cigarettes during pregnancy, most experts say it's best not to puff on these either. Electronic cigarettes, which claim to have significantly fewer toxins and less nicotine than traditional cigarettes, still contain enough to potentially affect your baby. Plus, it's hard to know just how much nicotine you're exposing yourself and your baby to, even though regulations require a warning statement saying that the product contains nicotine, additives, and flavorings. Bottom line, until more is known and until more regulation is in place, you're better off staying away from e-cigarettes. Same goes for hookah, in which the smoke from specially made tobacco passes through water and is then drawn through a rubber hose to a mouthpiece. Smoking a hookah is as toxic as smoking a cigarette. Despite what you may have heard, the water in the hookah does not filter out the toxic ingredients, like tar, carbon monoxide, and heavy metals, in the tobacco smoke. And what's worse, hookah smokers may actually breathe in more nicotine than cigarette smokers do because of the large volume of smoke they inhale during a session. Marijuana use.
I've heard that some women use weed to relieve morning sickness and other pregnancy symptoms because they think it's safer than medications. Is that true?
It's true that marijuana has experienced a surge in popularity among some moms-to-be, who see it as a safe alternative to medications for the relief of pregnancy pains, nausea, anxiety, and more. What isn't true, apparently, is that perception. In fact, both ACOG and AAP strongly urge expectant and breastfeeding moms to pass on pot in any form. Why the tough stance? It's because marijuana and its active drug, THC, passes through the placenta into a fetus's bloodstream and later into breast milk, which means a mom who uses weed shares it with her baby. And though researchers are still unsure of the exact effects of THC on a growing baby, the few studies that have been done show some risks, especially when a mom-to-be uses weed on a daily or even weekly basis. Researchers have found that babies born to mothers who use marijuana are twice as likely to end up in the NICU compared to other babies. Other studies show that pot use during pregnancy makes babies significantly more likely to be underweight at birth and have smaller heads. Weed during pregnancy is also linked to a higher chance of preterm labor. And if that's not enough, research shows long-term effects as well. Children born to marijuana-using moms score worse on cognitive, memory, and behavioral tests compared to other toddlers. These children also show a slightly increased risk of hyperactivity, inattention, and impulsivity, and score, on average, lower on reading comprehension and math skills when they reach school age compared to kids whose moms didn't use marijuana while they were pregnant. If you've already smoked or indulged in edibles early in your pregnancy, don't worry, but do quit now. Try to find ways to unwind and net that natural high, endorphin-releasing exercise, yoga, meditation, hypnosis, acupuncture. If your use of marijuana has been for medical reasons, say to relieve chronic pain, ask your practitioner about pregnancy-safe therapies.
For dads, your secondhand smoke. Moms-to-be definitely carry a heavy load, and most of the baby nurturing responsibilities, at least until baby's born. The exception When it comes to providing a smoke-free environment, Mom can't do it alone. If there is smoke in her environment, there's smoke and harmful tobacco byproducts in babies. Even if she doesn't light up herself, but you or others around her do, baby's body is going to pick up nearly as much contamination as it would if she smoked. Doing your smoking away from your pregnant partner is better than smoking around her, but you'll still be exposing her and baby to the toxins that stick to your clothes and skin. A very big, yet very little and vulnerable reason to quit? To give your baby to be the very best chances possible of being born healthy. But the benefits to your baby of having a smoke-free dad don't end at delivery. Smoking by either parent increases the risk of SIDS in infancy and of respiratory problems, lung damage, and other illnesses at all ages. And it ups the chances that your little one will become a smoker one day. Quitting now will give your baby a healthier home to be born into and a healthier life to live. Not to mention a chance to grow up with a healthier dad who's likely to live longer. Your baby will thank you also for not smoking cigars and pipes. Because they aren't inhaled, they release even more smoke into the air than cigarettes, making them more potentially harmful to your baby. So pass the chocolate cigars instead.
Eager to kick the smoking habit? You should be, because some studies show that women who quit smoking early in pregnancy, no later than the third month, can eliminate all of the associated risks. For some smoking women, quitting will never be easier than in early pregnancy, when they might develop a sudden distaste for cigarettes, probably the warning of an intuitive body. Sooner is better, but quitting even in the last month can help preserve oxygen flow to the baby during delivery.
Help quitting. Congratulations, you've decided to give your baby a smoke-free environment in utero and out, and you're mega motivated to quit. Luckily, there's plenty of help for smokers who want to kick butt. Among the strategies that have made quitters out of smokers, hypnosis, acupuncture, and relaxation techniques. If you're comfortable with a group approach to quitting, which builds in support, consider programs run by Nicotine Anonymous, the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Society, and Smoke Enders, or seek support online from other pregnant women who are trying to call it quits. Check out smokefree.gov or cdc.gov/tobacco/quit_smoking for more information and help. Wondering about the safety of nicotine replacement therapy, nicotine patches, lozenges or gums, or Chantix, a prescription drug used to curb cravings when you're expecting? Ask your practitioner. Most experts don't recommend these as first-line treatment for smoking cessation during pregnancy. Prescription for a healthy pregnancy. Coming into pregnancy with a squeaky clean lifestyle, no drinking, no smoking, and definitely no drugs, that's great news for you and your baby. But what about prescription medications? Depending on the meds you take, it may be time for some changes now that you're expecting. Say no to opioids. There's no question that the epidemic of opioid addiction has become a pervasive public health crisis in the U.S. But what about occasional use of these prescription pain meds, codeine, Percocet, Vicodin, and OxyContin, during pregnancy? The short answer, it's unsafe. Opioid exposure puts a developing baby at risk of birth defects and premature birth, as well as withdrawal after birth. Such so-called neonatal abstinence syndrome, NAS, triggers symptoms like seizures or tremors, excessive crying, and breathing and feeding problems. To protect your baby, tell your practitioner about any opioids you take, even if prescribed by another doctor.
Cocaine and other drug use.
I did some cocaine a week before I found out I was pregnant. Now I'm worried about what that could have done to my baby.
Don't worry about past cocaine use. Just make sure it was your last. On the upside, using cocaine once or twice before you found out you were pregnant isn't likely to have had any effect. On the downside, continuing to use it during pregnancy could be dangerous. How dangerous isn't quite clear. Since many cocaine users also are cigarette smokers, it's hard to separate the probably negative effects of cocaine use from the documented negative effects of smoking. What most studies have shown is that cocaine not only crosses the placenta, but can damage it, reducing fetal growth, particularly of a baby's head. It's also believed to lead to preterm birth, low birth weight, withdrawal symptoms in the newborn, and long-term neurological, behavioral, and developmental problems for the child, along with possibly lower IQ. Certainly, the more a mom-to-be uses cocaine, the greater risk to her baby. Tell your practitioner about any cocaine use or other illicit drug use, including heroin, meth, crack, ecstasy, ICE, and PCP, since you've conceived. If you have any difficulty giving up cocaine or other drugs entirely, get professional support to help you quit. Enrolling in a drug-free pregnancy program now can make a tremendous difference in the outcome of your pregnancy. Domestic violence. Protecting her baby from harm is every expectant mother's most basic instinct. But sadly, some women can't even protect themselves during pregnancy. That's because they're victims of domestic violence. Domestic violence can strike at any time, but it's especially common during pregnancy. While having a baby brings out a new or renewed tenderness in many relationships, it rocks others, sometimes triggering unexpectedly negative emotions in a woman's partner. From anger to jealousy to a feeling of being trapped, particularly if the pregnancy wasn't planned. In some cases, unfortunately, those emotions play out in the form of violence against both the mother and her unborn baby. Sometimes cultural or financial factors or a family history of domestic violence against women can contribute to a partner's aggression too. The statistics are alarming. Nearly 20% of all pregnant women experience violence at the hands of their partners, which means that an expectant mother is twice as likely to be the victim of domestic violence as she is to develop preeclampsia or deliver prematurely. More shockingly and tragically, domestic violence is the single leading cause of death among pregnant women. Domestic abuse, emotional, sexual, and physical against pregnant women carries more than just the immediate risk of injury to the mother-to-be and her baby, such as uterine rupture and hemorrhaging. Being battered during pregnancy can lead to numerous negative health consequences, including poor nutrition, poor prenatal care, substance abuse, and so on. Its effects on the pregnancy can also include